From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Innovation Friday is part of the Innovation Trail, and trail being the operative word, it's a great way to start our second hour. A survey commissioned by Parks and Trails New York finds 1.5 million people take to the Erie Canal Trail every year. And a large majority, nearly 90% of those, are on a bike. The survey finds that it creates, well, we're not going to give you the number just yet. We have to leave some people in suspense, but we're finally talking numbers about economic activity generated along the Canal Trail. There have been questions for a long time about economic value here, and my co-host for the hour is Matthew Leonard, who is the editor of the Innovation Trail. This was an eye-catching one just because this is people like to talk about the canal, but it's hard to get a number on it sometimes.
Right. No, it's a really useful discussion starter, I think, and to help us explain it, I'm glad to say we're joined by Fran Gotchick, who's the Director of Programs and Policy for Parks and Trails New York, who knows this report inside out, or pretty well anyway. Thanks very much for being with us, Fran. She's in our Rochester studio with us. So tell us a little bit about, I guess, you know, give us an overview of what, you know, what the report was intended to touch on.
Well, we have been working with the Canal Corporation for about 16 years and the Erie Canalway National Heritage Corridor since 2000 in promoting and helping develop and maintain the Erie Canalway Trail. And we have heard from business leaders, tourism officials, trail users, that the Erie Canalway Trail was having a very positive impact in the more than 200 communities along its length. But until now, we really didn't have any specific data to support that. So we were very interested in getting that kind of information because we felt that by having that data, it could better inform future business decisions and future marketing efforts all along the Erie Canalway Trail.
Right.
And so we commissioned a study. Dr. Paul Scipione from the Survey Research Center at the Jones School of Business at SUNY Geneseo conducted the study. And what we found was that the overall economic impact of the Erie Canalway Trail is about $253 million annually. And that's based on about 1.6 million visits to the trail each year. We found also that about the 18% of the people who we surveyed who stay overnight contribute 84% of all of that spending. So it's those overnight visitors spending primarily on lodging and bars and restaurants that are really having a significant impact. We also found that 92% of the people that are visiting the trail live in one of the 14 counties through which the Erie Canalway Trail passes. So we also found that 50% of the people that we surveyed lived within 5 miles of the trail. So there is a lot of local use, but in terms of the economic impact, it's really those overnight visitors and the people that told us that they were vacationing as on the trail and that the vacationing and the trail was part of their reason for being on the trail that have the greatest economic impact.
Does that also, I guess, that you know, that significant figure about local people being essentially local to the canal, is that also suggest an opportunity, I guess, for promotion outside of those communities, that there is room for growth for people who...
Oh, yes. To me, it shows that there's a tremendous room for growth. Many, many different opportunities to market the trail to a much wider audience. And, for example, Parks and Trails New York is just about ready to launch a marketing campaign aimed at the adventure cycler and the international and national cycling tourist. We are funded for this effort by a grant from the Market New York program of the Empire State Development Corporation. It was one of those CFA grants that we received last year. And with that effort, we are going to really, as I say, focus directly on that international and national adventure traveler and cycling tourists to get them to better know the wonderful cycling that's available on the Erie Canalway Trail. Because those people who we interviewed that said that they were vacationing on the trail, 96% of them said that the reason that they were vacationing on the trail and the reason that they were in the area is because they came for the Erie-Kanawha Trail. And it was the natural scenery and the good bicycling that attracted them to visit. So it's that kind of information that we're going to use and we're hoping that other people will use to inform and give them other options for marketing efforts. For example, we also found that more than 50% of the people that we surveyed said that even if they hadn't taken a long-distance trip or an organized cycling trip on the Erie Canal, they were very interested in doing so. So that says to lodging establishments, to entrepreneurs, there's a real opportunity here, maybe for some B&Bs or hotels and motels to get together and develop some packages that would appeal to people who might like to go maybe not the full distance from Buffalo to Albany, but maybe just an overnight or even a long weekend trip. And we haven't done enough of that, and that's something that we hope will result from our project.
So just a couple other numbers. I mean, you also, Dr. Paul Scipione also put some numbers on the number of jobs that he estimated were attached to it. A bit under 3,500 jobs was the
That's
number
correct.
He had. Yeah, $78 million in wages, labor income, and about $28.5 million in taxes. So that's quite a kind of bundle in terms, just on top of the quarter of a billion in sales that you know that he identified in that as well. What were there any surprises there in terms of you know, because he did actually there's a breakdown on a kind of typical users of the typical users was the sort of the local. The presence of local people rather than, say,
yes,
national, international travelers, that was a bit of a surprise.
Local people was a bit of a surprise. Also, we were very surprised that so many people said that they were interested in the history and also the fact that the typical Erie-Kanawha Trail user was primarily in that age group of 30 to 49. I might have guessed that it might have been slightly older than that.
Uh-huh.
But then we looked at the Erie-Kanawha Trail vacationer, and that's the people that said when they were interviewed that they were here visiting away from their home and classified their visit as a vacation. And for those people, more than 50% were baby boomers. And what was interesting is that more than 50% had a household income greater than $100,000. But in the typical Erie-Kanawha Trail visitor, I also was very pleased to see that the income figures there were more or less in line with those of the median household income in New York State. So it was a 30 to 49-year-old group that was pretty much on average with what you might find across the state in terms of household income.
If you want to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you if you use the Canal Trail. If you, especially as we've been hearing, certainly from Fran, a lot of people on a bike use it, but we'd love to hear from you. Weigh in at 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. We're right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Fran, for people who are just joining us, again, is with Parks and Trails New York. And this was a survey commissioned by Parks and Trails New York that found 1.5 million people take to the Erie Canal Trail every year, many of them on bikes, and they're creating about $250 million, more than that, in economic activity, equating to about $26 a person. And Fran, forgive the ignorant question, but let's back up for people who might have missed it. How do you make sure that your survey is sort of representative? How did how do you go about creating that survey to make sure that it's going to be accurate?
Well, that's why we went to Dr. Scipione, who has many, many, many decades of experience in doing this kind of thing. We designed a survey where we surveyed 562 people throughout the entire Erie-Kanawha Trail corridor. The surveying was done by SUNY Geneseo's students. And,
were they grabbing people on the trail, essentially?
They were instructed to randomly select trail users. and to interview them. And they didn't have to fill out the survey right on the trail. They were given a URL where they could log in once they got home and fill out the survey. It was on the survey at the server at SUNY Geneseo. We did some confidence level testing, and it showed that the number of surveys that we had and the results were within the 95% confidence level. So we feel pretty confident that what we have is good information. There's certainly always opportunities to do a better job. We would have loved to have, you know, obviously been able to interview more people over a longer period of time. We only interviewed from June until September of 2012. Ideally, you know, you would love to have been able to see what kind of usage there was during the winter time. We asked people about whether they visited the trail in the winter, and I think about 26% said that they did. But you might have gotten some different information if you'd been able to do that.
Right. I'm interested in the way in which I guess sometimes some of these tourist assets are seen as, I guess, as kind of soft, you know, soft or kind of relatively low priority in terms of the discussions around economic development. You know, a lot of discussions we have when we do this program are about, you know, nanotechnology and, you know, refurbishing industrial buildings, you know, kind of hard, that sort of stuff. And so sometimes the role of tourism, you know, isn't always in the same kind of conversation. We've certainly seen that a bit more under the Cuomo administration. It seems that there is a lot of, you know, discussion around that. But I assume it's really important to get some of these hard figures out there
for
really convincing investors, business community, and local authorities and funders that of the value of the asset.
Oh, that's right. And if you look at the survey in the back, there are some verbatims from business owners and from tourism officials. And some of them said, you know, we really want this information. If we've got this information, you know, that may make us feel like it's worth doing some more investment. And that's what we really hope. We hope that the information that is contained in this survey will instill confidence in business leaders, tourism officials, and government officials to continue to and additionally invest in marketing, in promotion, in economic development, and additional trail development and trail enhancement. Because before, no one had the numbers. And this is the first attempt to get some numbers. Now, we'd love to do an additional study some years hence to see what kinds of changes have been made in terms of visitation and in terms of economic impact. So we really see this survey as a baseline survey, and we hope that we'll continue to be able to do something like this periodically into the future.
Is this kind of informing any specific planning, you know, in terms of the trailway? I mean, I seem to recall there are sort of like segments of the trailway where there are still some decisions to be made about how to, you know, how they link up around particular community sectors.
Exactly. Since 2010, we have led what is called our Close the Gaps campaign. And Parks and Trails New York at that time partnered with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand to really try to raise the visibility of the need to complete the Erie Canalway Trail. Because when it is complete as a 360-mile off-road trail from Buffalo to Albany, it will be the longest intrastate trail in the nation. And I don't think there's any trail in all of the U.S. that has the iconic name recognition that Erie Canal does. But I think that a lot of people all across the world have heard of the Erie Canal, but they don't recognize or they don't know that there's such wonderful cycling and wonderful historic communities associated with it. And so we want to raise that visibility of completing the Erie Canalway Trail to close those 83 remaining gaps. And having this information makes it a lot easier for us to make the case with legislators and with others who may be able to help us to do that.
Hold that thought, Fran. Thank you. We've got a caller, I think.
Yeah, let's get to the phones here. And again, if you have comments on Canal, again, we'd love to hear if you use it, if you're down there, if Maybe you were riding a bike and you saw one of those students standing in front of the trail, waving their arms, asking for a server. That's not exactly how it happened. This is a familiar caller. This is Bonnie. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, hi. I was supposed to ask if you liked or knew the song Happy Trails. That's not why I'm calling.
No, see, poor John Andrews behind the glass, the engineer.
Yeah, right. He did that.
He's the puppet master. Yes.
Listen, one thing. The whole history in the Erie Canal is a wonderful thing. Two things. One is, I was sad to see that the Sam Patch Navigation Company had to take the Mary Jamison boat, which is primarily the one that goes from the city from Cornhill. Along the canal. They had to take it out because, I was told it needed a lot of repairs. I wish there was something they could do about that because they switched the whole thing, the Sam Patch boat, to Pittsford, which leaves the city kind of with a bare spot there to connect. Number two is, please, 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 when you have discussions like this with people who are knowledgeable about the Erie Canal, please try to build in ways of going to community groups in the city to talk about this so people... they don't know. They become reminded about that, the Erie Canal and what it offers. I think a lot of times people kind of know, but they don't know.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie. Yeah, and we definitely archive. You know, we definitely archive and turn this into a story that we share and keep on our website and communicate to other people. There is some background on this on innovationtrail.org. And I was interested too, Fran, something else that the very high levels of the power of the word of mouth, in terms of people. Just as Bonnie was saying, you know, people kind of being reminded about particular opportunities they might have. I just saw the figure here that the profile of the typical vacation of the person who's traveling, staying overnight, that over 40% of the people learned about the trail through, I guess, like the bike, the bike riders network, whatever, you know. So the importance of those kinds of travel blogs or informal groups and, you know, so on in terms of building user numbers around the asset.
And I was surprised, actually, that word of mouth was the greatest percentage in terms of when we asked the question, how did you learn about the Erie Canalway Trail? These were the ones for the vacationers. And what I thought was that it may result also from our cross-state bike tour. We get 500 riders, more than 500 riders some years, and they have a network. You know, they talk to their friends, and a lot of those who participate in our bike ride participate in other cross-state rides in other states. And so I think that may be a lot of it, that they heard about it from another friend, and so they checked it out. Because when we asked the question, how did you plan your trip, then the most cited response was our Erie Canalway Trail guidebook. And we've sold over 15,000 copies of our guidebook. We're now in the process of putting together the fourth edition. And so I thought that really what that was, heard about it from a friend who may have already biked it, either part of our ride or alone, you know, on their own. And then they went to our guidebook to plan their trip.
We have other comments from Twitter and on the phone. Let's get back to the phones. This is Doug in Canandaigua. Go ahead, Doug.
Hi. My favorite way to use the canal is kayaking, though I've done a lot of biking and cross-country skiing on it as well. With a friend when I was 60 and he was 70, we kayaked the Rochester to Albany on it, not in one season, probably over five seasons. Uh-huh. And we've also done the Seneca Lake and the Seneca Huga, as well as the Oswego. And it's just beautiful, historic, scenic. And we met great people on the way. I had my favorite two stories about it. We met one boater with about a 55-foot yacht with front thrusters waiting to go into a canal from Hawaii, and they had boated there from Hawaii. They were going to Chicago where they were going to ship it back. So just fascinating to meet someone that had gone that far in their boat.
Yeah.
And then we were around the Rotterdam, sitting in the Rotterdam lock, or about to go into the Rotterdam lock, and we were told by the lockkeeper that a large tour boat was coming, and we either had to wait for them to go through or share it. And we were impatient, said, well, we'll share it. So he said, well, you got to move up to the end. So we did that, and the tour boat came in kind of like a Viking cruise boat from Canada, filled the lock up, and we were in awe of it. And then yet all the people on the tour boat, I think, came up to the bow to look down at these little kayakers down there that they were made of. So I just had a great time with it.
That's a great image. Hey, Doug, just before you go, did you camp or stay along sections of the canal when you were?
We did not. Yep. I know people do sometimes. We chose to stay in motels and so forth along the way. We typically did 3 to 4 days at a stretch, and we would paddle 15 to 20 miles in a day and plan it out accordingly with where we could put in and take out as well as spend the night. And then we'd shuffle cars, so we were doing it one way.
Right. But there you are contributing to the $253 million a year through your overnight stays and so on.
Thanks for the call,
Doug. Yeah, and the people we met, I mean, I remember Canadians saying they couldn't believe how cheap it was to travel on the canal. And I hope that the state keeps it that way for foreigners because, I mean, you think of the dollars that they bring in terms of gas, groceries, lodgings, food. It's great. Keep up the good work with the canal.
Well, Doug, thanks for the call. And if you're just joining us, Fran Gotchik is our guest in studio on Innovation Friday here on Connection. She's the director of programs and policy for Parks and Trails New York. They commissioned a survey to find out the economic impact of essentially the canal trail every year. They found a $253 million economic activity impact with more than 1.5 million people using the Erie Canal Trail on an annual basis. And on Twitter, Christopher wants to know, so what's the lesson? We should increase canal funding or see more development along it? What would you say, Fran?
Well, I would like to see additional marketing efforts, additional efforts to draw visitors to the trail from not only locally, but from throughout the nation and abroad, because I think it will have an even greater impact on many, many small, wonderful historic communities all along the trail. You were talking in the first hour about the redevelopment of factory buildings along our old rivers and along the canal, and how the Preservation League is working to try to get more interest in doing that. There are so many different structures all along the canal. There's so much history there, and there's so many opportunities to use those resources to market to and really then eventually profit from the cycling tourist. So I'd love to see our study just be a catalyst for additional efforts to promote communities and promote cycling on the Canalway Trail.
And I know, I guess, part of the fabric of this is linking up to some of the other railway bike trails that are being developed. You know, there's ones out near significant ones that are being developed out near Buffalo, I believe, as well. So that there's a kind of people are able to kind of link up with some of the other sort of biking infrastructure.
Right, and that actually goes right to the heart of Parks and Trails New York's mission.
Yep.
Our mission has been for now almost 20 years to create a statewide network of parks, trails, and open spaces throughout the state for all to use and enjoy. And we've been involved with rail trails since the early 90s. And there are so many trails that intersect with the Erie Canalway Trail. Right here in Rochester, we have the Genesee Riverway Trail and the Genesee Valley Greenway. The Greenway taking you eventually almost to the Pennsylvania border, and of course the Riverway Trail taking you up to Lake Ontario. You mentioned Buffalo. Buffalo is doing a lot now to develop out their trail network. Albany also is developing some additional trails that link to the Canalway Trail at the Corning Preserve. And so we have always seen the Erie Canalway Trail as basically a major spine of a statewide trail network.
We're going to have time to get one more quick phone call in as our engineer John grabs that right now. And as we do that real briefly, Fran, for people who are kind of tuning in and hearing this $253 million impact number, what that is along the trail, that is not a total number on the canal, and I know that's an important distinction.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct. This is just associated with usage of the Erie Canalway Trail.
The right. Trail. Okay, again. So that's it's sort of part of the large pie of the Erie Canal. This is Carol in the city of Rochester. Carol, thanks for calling Connections.
Yeah, I tuned in late, and I don't know if you all were talking about the little boats that you can rent that you can sleep on, those little red and green boats. My daughters and I, my three daughters and I, rented one of those. Maybe 4 years ago, we got one out of Macedon. And we know nothing about boats. I mean, we, you know, I canoed when I was a kid at camp. But they gave us a little tutorial on how to run this boat. And we went, we didn't get too far. We were on the boat about 4 days. We didn't get too far. We thought we were going to try to get to Buffalo, and we didn't make it because we kept stopping along the way. And we took our bikes on top of this boat, and we would pull over to the side, and two of us would stay in the boat, and two of us would bike. And we had the best time. I think it was one of our best vacations.
Well, you must have known a little bit about boats, because you left two people on the boat so it didn't drift away from the people who were actually on the shore on the bikes. So you did, I think you were down. You sold yourself a bit short there about your nautical knowledge. But that's a great story, just about the way in which people, the mixed use, I guess. You
yes.
know, because though we're focusing
yes.
on the trail, there's an example of someone who's
absolutely yeah, Carol. Yeah. That I have always seen those boats, seen the bikes on top, and have wanted to do just what you just did, but I have never done it yet, and hope to sometime soon, because it does seem like a wonderful way to enjoy the communities, enjoy the trail, and also to enjoy the waterway as well.
Last word here, Matthew, as we close this conversation.
Well, just to quickly close out the conversation, and just perhaps to circle back a little bit on the industrial reuse conversation, which I know Fran heard as well earlier. I guess when we're looking at economic value, you know, in our discussion with the Preservation League, we were looking at, reuse of industrial buildings for residential and, you know, for commercial use and so on. This is also another way of rethinking about industrial legacy, but with, you know, a recreational outcome in mind. I guess this is part of that ongoing conversation, to sort of, you know, remind people of the, you know, the potential for reuse of industrial legacy for other, you know, things other than, a brownfield site or whatever.
Sure. B&B, hotel, restaurants. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity for that Erie Canalway Trail vacationer to have more choices for dining and for lodging that is very close to the trail. We don't have enough of that yet. And I'm hoping that these figures, as I've said before, will give people the impetus, the confidence to think about doing more of that kind of thing. Because I think that when you get more of those opportunities, that will draw more people and that will benefit everyone's business.
A little bit of synergy here. If this makes you think, maybe I would like to try to launch a business or develop something near the canal, these numbers help spur that idea. And next month on this program, we're going to have a round table on bed and breakfast. If you've ever said, I'm just going to quit what I'm doing and we'll start a bed and breakfast, you know, a lot of people say it, not a lot of people do it. We're going to find out what it takes to actually do it next month. So maybe we'll link up that idea.
Well, I'd also like to add that we do a roundtable called Bicyclists Bring Business, and we've done them in Erie Canalway Trail communities since 2006. We're hoping to do one this year in Tonawanda. And what that is an evening program that's designed for business leaders, government leaders, tourism officials, to give them tips on how things that they can do in their community to make it additionally attractive to the cycling tourist. And then what we do the next day, we do what we call a bike around. We get everyone out on a bike, and they get out on the trail, and they approach the community like they've never seen it before. And then it's an opportunity to kind of try to see a community through the eyes of a cycling tourist. Can you easily find a place to stay? Can you easily find a place to eat? Are those attractions visible? Do you know where they are? And it's really an eye-opening experience. And so we also have a guidebook that goes with that, and that's on our website, ptny.org.
ptny.org?
That's correct.
I got to jump in here only because we're about to run out of time. So ptny.org.
Right.
And I imagine they can find a lot more there as well.
Absolutely.
Friend. Thank you for
including
taking
the report.
Thank you for taking the time to come in and tell us all about it.
Thank you.
Fran Godchick from Parks and Trails New York. Thanks, Fran. And finally today, we're heading to a different, altogether different scenario. Forget about the scenic trailways,
as soon as we get to a break, you know.
Okay. All right. Make it a quick one.
That's part of my job. Let's get to a break. We'll be right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, what is the true value of the Finger Lakes? We're going to ask that question and get answers from the perspective of a photographer, a foodie, and a beverage connoisseur. Join us for that roundtable. And in the second hour, teachers are often on vacation. That's not totally fair to teachers. They work during the summer, but some are working harder than ever. It's a partnership between Rochester and Allendale, Columbia. We've got it on Monday. Welcome back to Connections. It's Innovation Friday. Matthew, what's next?
Finally, I wanted to touch on some recently declassified national security documents related to the Cold War era. Earlier today, I spoke to Bill Burr. Bill Burr is a senior analyst, and he directs the National Security Archives Nuclear History Documentation Project. He's an analyst who's got a particular interest in working on declassifying formerly secret documents to do with nuclear warfare in the US. And I asked him about a particular release of documents that came out earlier this week. And he began by talking about what the vision of the National Security Archive is.
We've been based in Washington. We founded in Washington in the mid-1980s. And our mission has been to go try to shed light on U.S. government decision-making and national security policy, you know, foreign diplomacy, military policy, intelligence policy, to try to get important documents declassified that will shed light on ongoing discussions and debates on American society. We have a number of projects. People work on just different projects in the archive. We have people working on Central American issues, like Guatemala, El Salvador, also Mexico. There's projects on the Southern Cone, on Argentina and Chile, projects on Northeast Asia, Korea, and Japan, projects on sort of the background of the global warming debates, history of global warming, history of the policy on global warming, environmental change. And I've been working on U.S. nuclear policy for some time, trying to look at key issues and aspects of U.S. nuclear weapons policy over the years, trying to get key documents, important documents on various topics declassified.
Right, exactly. And an incredibly substantial. I really commend the website, the web presence that the archive has to our listeners in terms of just some fascinating insights into the topics that you've mentioned there. And your particular area of interest is kind of captured in a little space called the Nuclear Vault, which I kind of like that idea. Just give people a bit of a sense of when you say declassify, have documents declassified. Just give people some sense of the sort of process that's involved that it takes to actually get certain documents into the public domain.
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's complex because nuclear. A lot of issues the archive makes requests on. Some have involved complex diplomatic issues and sensitivities, like U.S. relations with another country, like Guatemala or El Salvador, and even some very sensitive issues. But the nuclear issue is particularly difficult because involves sometimes military, what are considered military secrets by some of the agencies. It could involve sometimes intelligence information. It can sometimes involve foreign policy information, such when you're talking about nuclear deployments in other countries during the Cold War. There's, diplomatic issues and sensitivities that arise about deployments overseas. And so there's a lot of different offices and agencies in the U.S. government, from the State Department, the CIA, the Defense Department, with all complex bureaucracy at the Defense Department, and many of them claim the right to review information, so they want to have their 2 cents in before something goes out. So they get a sort of. Also, the Department of Energy is involved, sort of on certain nuclear issues, certain nuclear secrecy issues. So you get a very complex problem that gets quite protracted, and something can get reviewed at one agency quickly, and then the same document gets stuck in a bureaucratic limbo for a while. So it sometimes takes quite a while, and then, of course, sometimes information gets denied. We make a request. For example, in some of these reports we're talking about today, some of them were released in massively excised form, so I had to frame an appeal to try to get the agency. I had the right to appeal, so I had the agency. So the agencies looked at the issue, at the documents one more time. The review process is coordinated by the National Archives in this case. So it took a while to get the information returned, but it did work. I got more information released, but it was quite a protracted process.
Well, in fact, it was. I think is it true that it was kind of almost a decade from you know, the beginning of the process to now.
Yes, it was. And I think, yeah, it just partly there's, you know, time. There are a lot of agencies had to get their 2 cents in. There are budget problems. You know, the declassification is sort of like a unfunded mandate in the U.S. government, so it never gets the kind of resources that are really needed to get material declassified, such as this.
Right.
And things sometimes get lost in the shuffle. You know, things get this way mislaid, and things happen, and there are just delays that are unfortunate. But
that comes.
So it did take a while. You know,
that comes as a complete surprise to me that things might get
yeah.
lost in the shuffle. So tell us a little bit about this particular set of documents released just a couple of days ago, July 22nd. Yeah. Reports of the NET Evaluation Subcommittee. Kind of paint us a picture of the context. The period we're
sure.
talking about, and what do you think is so interesting about these documents?
Well, the NET Evaluation Subcommittee was a subcommittee of the National Security Council. It was, you know, created in the mid-1950s under the Eisenhower administration. And it was a highly secret organization. It was only mentioned in the media one time in the 1950s in an offhand way when someone was killed in a plane crash, and they said he worked at the NET Evaluation Subcommittee. But there was no explanation. No one followed up. There's nothing there's nothing in the media at all for decades and decades. It was a highly secret organization, a highly secret process. Nuclear war in the 1950s, the idea of nuclear war was horrifying then as it ever has been. It's a let me put this again. The concept of nuclear war was a highly sensitive issue, highly terrifying issue. The Eisenhower administration really did not want people to know that it was looking at nuclear war scenarios and their possible outcomes, what could happen to either side, what the cost would be. The fact that the government was looking at this issue would probably cause headlines around the country, cause some alarm. The government's taking it this seriously, that there could be a nuclear war, that this could cause massive casualties and terrible consequences for all parties involved. And I think this was just a terribly sensitive issue and a scary issue, and I think they just wanted to keep it secret. And so it stayed secret for decades and decades until the 1980s, I think. It was really, there were documents that got declassified that sort of showed the existence of the committee, but it took a lot longer to get the actual substance of the reports that it prepared, the sort of the net results of the nuclear war, the net consequences for either side of nuclear conflict.
So essentially, in looking, I mean, these documents, the ones that you've uploaded, they go through particular scenarios. They talk about casualty figures in the tens of millions on the continental
right.
U.S. They talk about what kind of options or sort of drop-off points there would be for taking particular courses of action. And they kind of, they're hypotheticals, but they're kind of written in a sort of an immediate past language as if this has actually happened. So they're presenting a scenario and then walking through what the consequences of a number of different nuclear scenarios would be.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. So, like you say, the information to cover these reports involved not only what they thought the Soviet Union would do in such a conflict, how the U.S. would respond militarily, what kind of targets would be focused on by U.S. forces, and how the Soviets might react. So there's a lot of intelligence information and guessing. So that was another reason for the sensitivities, that the CIA was involved in this, developing these reports, and they used a lot of intelligence information about Soviet forces, what they thought the Soviet force levels were. So again, that was another aspect of the secrecy, the intelligence secrecy. But most of the studies at the very beginning sort of assumed a Soviet attack, that the Soviets would attack U.S. Air Force bases, urban industrial centers, other kinds of military installations, using bombers. So it would be a bomber attack scenario in the 1950s before the Soviets or either side really had intercontinental ballistic missiles. And the scenarios changed once the Soviets assumed to have a missile force and the U.S. started developing a missile force. You have missiles targeting various installations, the United States or the Soviet Union. It was just when the scenarios start getting more grim, because there was some thought at the beginning that the U.S. could use air defenses to get to attack bombers, incoming bombers. But once missile forces were getting involved, the scenarios become more and more grim, and the level of damage is even becomes more and more, you know, already catastrophic, but sort of beyond catastrophic in terms of the dangers and consequences of missile attacks.
And also, I think you mentioned in your analysis that these documents, and we're talking about documents, I guess this latest release are sort of the early 60s, right? 61, 62, 63. So the Kennedy administration, and the tail end of the Eisenhower administration into the Kennedy administration, and that it also changes perceptions about the potential of the U.S. as a nuclear aggressor in these conflicts as well.
Well, somewhat, yeah. I mean, the initial scenarios assumed, you know, the Soviet Union would be attacking United States targets. But all through this period, the Air Force, U.S. Air Force, and some people involved in targeting, assumed that if you had intelligence information that was sort of conclusive, showing that the Soviets were about to launch an attack, that the U.S. should probably go first and preempt a Soviet attack by attacking Soviet targets and trying to destroy Soviet nuclear forces before they were launched. So they're a preemptive attack. And so during the Kennedy administration, some of the scenarios for the reports of 62 and 63 assumed different types of attack, retaliatory but also preemption. So sort of launching first based on intelligence warning. The assumption of preemption was that somehow the U.S. would get an advantage by striking Soviet military targets first. But by 1963, any thought of advantage had sort of dissipated, and President Kennedy heard a report on a preemptive attack on Russia, and the Soviets would be able to respond and cause enormous damage to the United States anyways. And so Kennedy sees sort of a stalemate, that both sides are sort of checking each other, that neither side can get an advantage. There's no possibility of prevailing. And when they talked about prevailing, they didn't mean no destruction and no damage. They meant that somehow the U.S. would come out ahead militarily. The U.S. would have still more military forces available than the Soviets. But so preemptive even was no longer an option, even though the Air Force for years and years would still have the preemptive option in the war plans. You know, by the time Kennedy's around, the early 1960s, the Kennedy administration then realized that preemption is no solution. And you really have to avoid, and Kennedy's biggest preoccupation was finding ways to avoid nuclear war and confrontation.
Right, and the preemptive strategy was something that was sort of driven by Curtis LeMay, was it not?
Well, that's right. He was, you know, but he was certainly hawkish and not uniquely so. But he was took a very hard line. He was certainly a supporter of an early attack on the Soviet Union if there was any intelligence warning. He was ready to go if there was to launch a preemptive attack from the very beginning. So he was certainly in that camp of the Air Force that supported, sort of launch on warning policy.
Right. So just getting back to the sensitivity of some of the information, I mean, they did scope quite detailed scenarios around the impact on civilian populations, not just military assets. They looked at the impact on the banking system, for example, on food supplies, on the potential for the impact on birth effects, you know, scenarios over a year or two, impact on farming capability, industrial capability, and so on. And you can see in that detail, I guess, very clearly why they the intense level of secrecy that you mentioned earlier was prevailing.
That's right. And I guess some of us, you know, they looked very closely at every aspect of the situation, from human losses, the economic consequences, in terms of, like you say, the banking system had to find ways to, you know, work in a different environment. And a lot of this was, I guess, it was based on, you know, ongoing civil defense planning. So I guess it wasn't concocted, but they looked at, you know, U.S. civil defense planning as it stood. And those kinds of, you know, things were taken into account. They had to find ways to develop, to maintain, financial exchanges in a post-war environment, and there were plans that the civil defense authorities made in that respect. For years and years, this is sort of an ongoing activity to be ready for this situation.
So, in that sense, the work of the subcommittee was kind of percolating out into the public discourse in a kind of softened form, or in the form of a public information campaign, without actually drawing the connection to this, obviously, these more hardline scenarios that were being presented at the high levels of the administration.
Yeah, but only very in a only very general sense. I mean, people knew, you know, that there were, you know, scenarios of nuclear war. There were novels based on scenarios of nuclear war. You know, so On the Beach, for example, back in the late 1950s, and all kinds of, you know, very popular films in the United States in the early 60s. Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove and so forth, but sort of sometimes fantastical scenarios, but sometimes some based on some real, you know, real issues, real concerns.
Yeah. So tell us just what was different from the earlier redacted or heavily redacted versions of the documents that you'd seen and the ones that were released after appeal? Did you, I guess I'm just interested in whether you had a sense as a researcher and a scholar of what was there and you just needed the evidence, or were there genuine surprises there for you in terms of what was eventually revealed in what we should tell people are still heavily excised versions of the original documents? I mean, you're still going after additional information in this.
That's a good question. You know, it's so long ago.
Yeah, right.
I wrote these appeals. But, I mean, from sort of the top of my head, I think some of the issues, for example, that there were excisions about the kinds of, you know, targets that were focused on in these scenarios. And, you know, military targets were always part of U.S. nuclear planning. The, you know, the Soviet nuclear forces, Soviet bases, missile sites, bomber bases, and so forth. Those were sort of basic targets that were routine. And I think some of those early reports that I got, the early versions, excised a lot of the targeting categories. But that information had been declassified in other formats over the years. So I think I probably sent them examples of documents that had the target types and the target sets. And I said, well, you know, you can release more information on that basis. And there are other things, too, which I probably called their attention to when I did an appeal. So you got more information, and then the target sets and the target types, was that kind of information was declassified. But some stuff just stays classified. The Department of Energy and Defense Department continue to protect, you know, the sort of the nuclear yields of the attacks. So there's some information is excised about how many megatons, the total, how many hundreds and hundreds of megatons for the total attack by the U.S. On the Soviet Union. And mostly that information stays classified, even though it's totally hypothetical, you know, hypothetical scenario to begin with, and the situation has changed so much, and the types of weapons have changed. So I appealed that. I said, you know, this information is long overtaken by events.
Right.
But nevertheless, they keep it classified because there are some agreements between the Defense Department and the Atomic Energy, the Department of Energy, the Defense Department, that keep it classified. And so it's just one of these ongoing situations that are hard to fix. But the information stays secret. Although one of the documents I have did get declassified, or got declassified the National Archives. It did give some of those total, you know, the total weight of the attack was declassified for a couple of the early scenarios. And that's there. But that's pretty exceptional. I'm not sure how to account for it, why it was released.
They just somehow got through.
So what out
of this period, this really intense Cold War period that you're focusing on, what are you going after now in terms of what other sort of useful information do you think there is there to sort of get access to, and that you're currently appealing for?
Yeah. Actually, some of the reports that are presented in this release, this publication for this week, I'm still trying to get some of the fuller versions of the reports just to see what the fuller reports show. And that's going to be an ongoing process. But I have, you know, a number of requests on U.S. policy, but also I've done a lot of work on U.S. nuclear proliferation policy, U.S. policy, sort of international policy towards the proliferation of nuclear weapons. So I have ongoing requests on various aspects of that issue. You know, the U.S. concerns about nuclear activities in Pakistan during the 1970s and 80s, the Israeli nuclear program, U.S. policy towards that. And some documents, you know, some material does get declassified over time, but I have ongoing requests on Israel and Pakistan, and also India. Other countries that were of concern to the U.S. government, international community, in terms of nuclear programs, and even the Chinese nuclear program. I've got some requests on the impact of the Chinese nuclear program. You know, actually, it's the 60th anniversary of the first Chinese test is coming up in October.
Right.
And there was a lot of concern at the time, in the early 60s, before China tested, that if China tests the bomb, that maybe the Indians might want nuclear weapons, that even Japan might want nuclear weapons. All these scenarios of a sort of a spiraling effect, that you could get a proliferation chain if China goes nuclear. And it did have some consequences. I think one of the concerns for the Indian program in India after China tested was that India became more interested in nuclear options. And it took them, it was another 10 years before they actually tested a device. But their concern about China, I think, did influence India's nuclear program. Because only a few years before the Chinese test, India and China had been in conflict over their borders.
Right.
And this had an impact on both sides.
I've been talking to Dr. Bill Burr from the National Security Archive, in particular the Nuclear Documentation Project. Dr. Burr, thanks very much, and we'll put some assets up on our website to make sure people get a chance to go through these really fascinating documents that you've uncovered.
Well,
through persistence and scholarship, clearly.
Well, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your good questions. It was interesting. Yeah.
There'll be information on innovationtrail.org, but you can also go to the National Security Archive at the George Washington University for some pretty riveting reading. And just in case you missed that, it's taken 12 years for Dr. Bill Burr to go through the appeal process to have those documents from 1961 and 62 released in a form that he's able to release earlier this week, unredacted.
Matthew Leonard, editor of the Innovation Trail. They can find the Innovation Trail online where, Matthew?
InnovationTrail.org. And don't forget our Affordable Care Act project, ACAWXXI at WXXI.org, or go to WXXI.org and click on the Affordable Care Act survey on the upper right-hand corner. Thanks for having me, Evan.
Always nice to have you. And John Andrus, always nice to work with you, our engineer today. I'm Evan Dawson. This has been Connections on Innovation Friday. Have a great weekend. This is member-supported public radio.